I wrote the text of this episode on June 4th, 2020, knowing that this episode won't be released for another 3 weeks. It's hard to know how to tune this narrative towards potential current events. But I have an optimistic heart. I hope that the current protests over systemic racial inequalities will be bearing fruit in the form of charges filed against officers not yet charged for assault or murder, and policy changes from the local to the national levels. Along with this, I hope for changes to education and healthcare. And I hope that COVID-19 cases will be dropping, along with unemployment rates, so that we can slowly begin to move towards a new, but brighter normal. But who can say what will happen? The one thing I don't want is a return to the status quo. So, if this episode's content feels terribly distant from current events, well, now you know why. In a way, however, the content of this podcast feels more relevant now than it did back in 2017, when I first started researching both bots and witches. The early modern period saw polarization, uncertainty, and conflict across Europe. Much of this expressing itself in violence against vulnerable communities and individuals in the forms of the Inquisitions and the witch trials. I want to be careful not to draw too many similarities between the early modern accused witches and what Black and Brown Americans have been experiencing for hundreds of years. The contexts and foundational histories are fundamentally different. But there are structures and human behaviors at play that are certainly similar. And it's worth looking into history to tease out potential tools for crafting a better, more equitable society that fulfills the cause for justice. So, why did the early modern witch trials happen? What were the larger circumstances that led to the chronic cycles of witchcraft accusations, trials, and executions? Dr. John Callow is visiting lecturer in history at the University of Suffolk and begins.
Every age can be said to be an age of rapid change, of haves, of have-nots, of the powerful and the powerless, of dislocation, of religious conflict, of war. The early modern period is often thrown into very stark relief by the knowledge of the Reformation, the terrible religious wars that stripped Europe just as surely as they stripped altars.
Dr. Marion Gibson is professor of Renaissance and Magical Literatures at the University of Exeter.
So across Europe, the Catholic Church, which had been the church since the foundation of Christianity, was being challenged by people who were thinking newly about Christianity. They were protesting, so they called themselves Protestants. And it was also a period, people have also argued, it was a period of climate change. It was a period when there were bad harvests. It was a period, as many periods are, of economic dislocation. There were refugee crises, there were people moving around in new ways. There were all sorts of reasons why people were upset in the early modern period and why they were perhaps looking for people to blame for their problems. But I'd point to the religious divide as being the thing that may have kicked off the witch trials.
Dr. Ronald Hutton is professor of history at the University of Bristol and a leading authority on the history of the British Isles in the 16th and 17th centuries.
The witch trials across Europe are the result of a development in Christian belief around about 1400, associated with the general creeping loss of nerve in Western Christianity, the reappearance of epidemic disease after centuries in the shape of bubonic plague, and slowly but steadily worsening weather, which destroys farming systems and limits the amount of food you have. All this indicates a very angry God. And as part of this general weakening of nerve, a new idea appears that God, good though he is, has licensed the devil to grant evil human beings the use of magic powers in order to hurt other humans, in order to test human faith properly. And once you accept this idea, millennia-old fears about bad magic suddenly become urgent. And the people who had this new idea said it was a new problem. They didn't suggest initially that people earlier in the Middle Ages, the ancient world, had faced that threat. They said it was something genuinely novel that God had now pulled out in preparation for a final judgment of humanity.
Professor Marion Gibson continues.
So I think the early modern witch trials happened for a variety of reasons. One of those was to do with religious change in Europe in the period. And thus you had the great divide beginning between the Catholic and Protestant churches. And because there was that divide, because it was no longer clear what the truth was, it was very easy for people to start thinking of their neighbours as perhaps being on the other side, not on God's side, but on the devil's side. So therefore, you might think that because there were good people in the church, you know, there were vicars and deacons and bishops and so on. Therefore, on the other side, on Satan's side, there might be people of equivalent rank and status, and those people might be witches. They might be there in your community. They might be there afflicting you.
The tension between good and evil strikes me as one of the most foreign things about the early modern trial records. I'm not a relativist, but I find the idea of embodied, externalized forces of good and evil entirely foreign to my worldview. People commit horrific acts, which are evil, certainly. But I think the reasons are more complex than, well, evil spirits compelling people to do bad things, or good spirits convincing people to do good things for that matter. We all make choices, and those choices affect others for good, for ill, and sometimes a bit of both. But this is my very modern secular worldview. And it isn't fair to the nuance of the early modern period. So, how did the early modern person conceptualize this binary split between good and evil? And how did this play into conceptions of magic and witchcraft? Professor Owen Davies is a member of the History Department at the University of Hertfordshire.
So at first in medieval prosecutions, we are talking about educated high-end magicians a lot of the time, or we get aristocrats who are accused of employing magicians to get courtly favors, to broke love, etc. So there's already a concern there at the same time as, you know, magic is a key part of medieval exploration of science and religion. So out of this medieval interest grows this concern that actually a lot of the magic that being practiced is diabolic. If these harmful uses of magic is on the rise, who's behind it? The devil. But all the time, underneath that, there is constant fear at a popular level in witches. Then in the mid-15th century, we get a series of outbreaks of apparent heresy. The inquisitors are going investigating, they're using torture. They seem to be finding these covens of witches who are doing the devil's work, and it seems to be increasing, seems to be growing. And of course, the use of torture means that people confessing. And herein lies another key component of the rise of the witch trials, because at the same time, we get the rise of the printing press. And so, you know, within decades of all of these trials taking place in Central Europe, the trial material is being written by Dominican and Franciscan monks, and they're disseminating around Europe. at the same time, that's what leads to the creation of laws. So in a sense, the witch trials is all about the elite concerns opening up the possibility through legal means for the poor to be able to pursue what they've always feared, which is witches.
This phenomena of a small group of elites vying for power amidst an increasingly dissatisfied majority is a familiar story. It's happening right now in the United States and elsewhere. This experience can be witnessed throughout human history, sometimes at a massive, organized scale, from the Roman Revolution to the Iranian Revolution. The setting of the early modern witch trials was not a grand, unified uprising, however. Rather, it was a period of intense and often chaotic conflict, both religious and political. Dr. John Callow.
To an extent, witchcraft is the product of a crisis in the elites to hold control, to hold power in their societies. The judges are scared. They don't know what's happening. It used to be thought witchcraft persecution came out of this collapse of the facade of the Roman Catholic Church, the struggle between Catholic and Protestant. So on one side, the elites are worried and they're struggling for control, and they're prepared to be far more heavy-handed and to satisfy, in many occasions, the bloodlust of the populace to actually do this and to curry favour. On the other hand, however, it's also the product of particular divergences, differences in the way that God, the Christian God, was perceived by people across Europe. The idea of the immanent God, the God who throws thunderbolts, the God of the Old Testament who can be angry and savage and destroy you almost at a whim or a click of the fingers, was losing out, particularly after Descartes and the Cartesian, very mechanistic, very empiricist view of society, to the transcendent God, the God perhaps in many respects we're more familiar with today, who operates outside human cognition and human experience. However, those people who believed in the immanent God, the God of the thunderbolts, the God of the Old Testament, when they fought their rear guard, when they tried to prove that God really did have a place in human affairs to defend a particular orthodoxy, the easiest way to do it is through miracles or through a struggle between light and dark, good and bad. How does God prove himself in human affairs? Well, the most gripping, the most obvious, perhaps the most easily provable to a pamphlet writer was the struggle between God and his eternal adversary, the devil. Therefore, you get an interest in witches.
Dr. Charlotte Rose Miller is a University of Queensland Fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies.
In the Reformation in England, we see an increased fear of the devil's presence in the world, that the last days are coming, that the devil is ramping up, basically. And this is also where witchcraft comes in, that there's the idea that the devil is recruiting, and he's recruiting witches to help in the last days. So a lot of the pamphlets have this kind of apocalyptic language, and they say in these last days we see more and more witches, more famines, more floods. There's really a sense that the devil is coming and it's war kind of waging.
Dr. John Callow continues.
The witch trials have often been framed in binary terms, good against evil, men against women. Of course, the truth is often not white or black, but various shades of grey. We can't get away from the fact that women-hating misogyny was a cornerstone of the trials. You can't read those trial confessions. You can't read the works of the great demonologists without being aware of their deep, scarring misogyny, their women hatred. Having said that, the way accusations were framed and pursued was a far more complex matter. Very often, they were formed by younger women, in crowds, if you like, who were of childbearing age or had small ones, against an older outgroup of women who were impoverished and were quite literally on the margins of society.
Professor Owen Davies.
It's complex. Part of this is religious, and it is Christian, and it is about the notion in the Bible of women being made in the image of Eve, and Eve was the one who was first tempted, that women are weak, feeble, more liable to want to enact harm and envy and use powerful magic to do that. But there are other more subtle reasons that are to do with social relations at a neighborly level. When you start looking at the individual cases, you find that, you know, women are central to accusing other women. Some of it, again, is to do with female society in a workaday situation where witchcraft accusations might arise from misfortune around the home, around the dairy, or in childbirth. And there's a whole series of trials in Germany which have been very well studied, you know, which is very much associated between female relationships, between midwives and those who are giving birth, and the things that happen in that room. And when misfortune happens, who are the people most immediately around? It's other women. Women beyond childbearing age might be more prone to witchcraft because young women, when they're looking at the misfortune that might have happened to them, they might be thinking, and we certainly have the evidence, that surely the person who's most got some spite and envy are going to be those women who can't give birth anymore. They're jealous. They're jealous of the young women.
It would be nice, but it's simply not possible to truly put yourself in another person's shoes. However, empathizing with others is the very first step in actualizing equity and justice. And empathy is important when mining history for tools to the challenges of the present. Early modern women were stuck between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, they lived in a world where everything from child rearing to legal action to finances was completely dictated and controlled by male family members, the courts, and the church. At the same time, they were under incredible pressure to bear and raise children. And for less affluent women, which was the majority, they also worked incredibly hard to keep their families alive by providing food, clothing, shelter, maintaining livestock, and often working for wealthier families. To compound this, centuries of misogyny were embedded within the larger religious practices. Their very faith reviled them. When we try to empathize with these women and imagine the incredible day-to-day stress they must have endured, it's less surprising they turned upon one another in accusations of witchcraft. Dr. Charlotte Rose Miller continues.
So we usually think of witches as female, and that's generally true, but there are definitely male witches. Male witches in England, for example, make up about 10% of the accused. That's quite a similar number for most of Europe. In a way, people, I think, are more likely to believe that these women will join with the devil. Firstly, because there's a belief at the time that women are more likely to succumb to the devil. People believe that women are more, firstly, easily tricked. And so if the devil comes and tries to trick you, you're more likely to give in. And also more naturally malicious. So even if you're not tricked, you're more tempted anyway. Also, that these women don't have any power at all. So the devil offering them power, you can sort of see the appeal of that. They're normally quite old. So often in their 60s or even 80s, which is extremely old for this period. I mean, people have a much lower life expectancy. So even someone in their 60s is quite old. They're often unprotected. So that means that they're sometimes widowed or unmarried. They're often living at the margins of a society, and they often are very, very poor. Say somebody comes begging at my door and they're an old woman, they're very poor, and they ask me for some milk and I don't give them any milk, which is bad because I should be charitable and I should give milk, but I didn't. So I'm feeling vaguely guilty about that. And that's where emotions come in. So then I leave and I hear the old woman curse under her breath or swear under her breath. And she wanders off, and the next day my cow drops dead, which happens, and we don't know why. But then I remember that that woman cursed my cow, and then I don't have to feel guilty anymore that I didn't give her milk because she was an evil witch and her anger killed the cow.
Witchcraft accusations were common and ordinary parts of life. And because hostility towards both women and witchcraft was so pervasive, these biases were institutionalized from secular and church courts to the individual mindset. From that vantage, it's no wonder it took centuries for most witchcraft accusations to finally end in Europe and the United States, long after laws were struck from the books. Witchcraft accusations most often started from ordinary individuals. But it was the social and legal structures in place that allowed these accusations to result in the massive trials and executions of the 16th and 17th centuries. Dr. Marian Gibson continues.
It was easy to accuse somebody of witchcraft. You could start off having a very ordinary relationship with that person, and maybe even a friendly one. But if something went wrong in that process, perhaps they'd offered to perform a service for you and it hadn't gone well, or you had a few crosswords with them, or something had happened in your life and you decided this person probably didn't like you as much as they pretended that they were, you could very easily start thinking that they might have, because you lived in a magical world, they might have used magical powers against you.
In all acts of civil disobedience, it is our voices which are both weapon and armor. And in early modern Europe, those most often accused of witchcraft were at the very fringes and margins of their communities. Yet even these most outcast community members could wield their voices. And despite everything stacked against them, they did. Dr. John Callow.
Now, if we think about what weapons the poor, the defenseless, the downtrodden, the marginal have in any society, it's very often their tongue. Without wealth, without a circle of friends in powerful places, and without physicality, your tongue and the way you use speech and words can define you, and it can also give you power. If people know they're going to get a tongue lashing or a bad word or a bad look from you, they'll often stay out of your way. Or they may press the odd coin or morsel of food into the palm of your hand just to see you on the way, just to get you out of the way. Invariably, it's a sense of guilt and misattributed guilt allied to a later misfortune that sparks and spirals the charges and countercharges of witchcraft. In almost every case, though, it's something that was profoundly unsettling. The animal in the unexpected place scuttling across the hearth. The fact that suddenly things go wrong linked to the presence of a particularly unlucky, unfortunate, or malignant individual.
When learning from history, I try to be objective and distant. I try to understand the myriad contexts and conflicting interests that weave these stories into a particular time and place. And I don't believe in embodied good and evil. That's just my modern framework. But I do believe that, throughout history, some people have made truly horrific and evil decisions which resulted in torture, enslavement, and death. Likewise, there have been truly remarkable people who have made decisions and taken actions that are so fundamentally grounded in a fierce devotion to the justice and wellness of others that the word goodness simply feels too small to embrace that impact. And throughout history, there have been individuals whose names have been lost in the scattering of texts and memories. But these individuals performed acts of both good and evil that have echoed down through the generations into today. Each of us is capable of both good and evil, and it is a great gift to be made aware of how one's actions affect others. I truly believe it's one of our most valuable human assets. Because I'm not a relativist, I maintain certain ideals which I stand by and act upon. But because I'm a realist, I try to be flexible enough to run towards my weaknesses in order to conquer them. My biggest fear isn't the total collapse of society or another 6 months of pandemic. My biggest fear is the status quo. Because I don't want my son to have to explain privilege to his children, not in the same way I have to explain it to him. I'd rather his generation have their own demons to tackle. In the next episode of Familiar Shapes, we'll dig into the very heart of this entire series. Misinformation. What exactly is it? How do we distinguish it from true information? And how is dangerous false information spread on social media? This is Heather Freeman. Thanks for listening. Be safe and well. No.